Route 616, your home for all fans of Marvel main continuity. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is episode 73 of Route 616. The whole crew is here. We've got Bill.
Hey.
And Dan, a.k.a. Monochromatic hey. Man.
You should have gone all in and worn a black and white t-shirt, too, instead of something
Oh,
like
I probably
color.
Should have, yeah.
Timeless.
Yeah, you're right.
Timeless Dan.
Yeah, and with us as well as our sidekick, Nutsack. Say hello, Nutsack.
Hi.
The worst thing is that name never clicked on me when I read that comic until you started tittering about it, and it's like, how did I not notice that? Probably because I wasn't paying much attention to that comic when I read it, because it wasn't that interesting. Yeah.
It's pretty Marvel to have a ridiculous name like that, too.
Yeah, I just kind of tuned them out.
It's like the Guardians of the Galaxy character in the movie that they make fun of.
Oh, that narrows it down.
Taserface?
Yeah, Taserface, that guy.
He's my hero. Yeah. It's okay, I still haven't watched Guardians 3.
Neither have I. I have no desire to see it.
I mean, I haven't watched any MCU movies besides Black Widow and Spider-Man No Way Home since Endgame yet. So, I'm stuck in Iron Fist Season 2 for my watchers still. So.
Good luck with that.
It's not
bad. Iron Fist Season 2 is better than Iron Fist Season 1.
It is. It's
That's
actually been,
saying anything.
It's been consistently watchable and good so far.
I mean, a social disease is still a social disease. It doesn't matter which one you have.
What is the difference between epidemic and pandemic?
Yeah. Pretty much. You know.
Shit.
You can have dermatitis or you can have, like, you know, syphilis. They both suck.
Yeah, but one of them is the result of sucking.
Yeah. Okay, he's not wrong.
Oh my, what a start to this podcast.
Let's talk
if
about
people
SSDs.
Would actually watch this and expected us to be focused.
Yeah, in the unlikely event anybody is actually watching this, I think we're living up to expectations.
Yeah, if you think they can't get any worse, they sure can, folks.
Oh boy, there are no depths we will plumb for a giggle. Seriously.
Sounds like Dan's dating advice.
My dating life? trust me. No, you know what? We're not going there.
We found it. We found the depth.
Yeah, well, this is a public broadcast, so there's certain things that we can't talk about. And the price I paid for the love I got, no. Yeah, it goes well beyond money. But beyond the obvious, all right, what are the other two dumbass white guys doing today?
Reading bad comics and watching football.
Okay, so you're watching the Man U Wolverhampton game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did either of you hear about the Chelsea-Liverpool game?
Or I saw the highlights.
Bloodletting, as it was called.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it.
For you, I don't think Chelsea fans enjoyed it much, but you know what?
But
they're Chelsea
they
fans, so they deserve it.
Yeah, but I don't think any of them were exactly surprised.
Do Chelsea fans enjoy life at all?
Only because they're not Man U fans.
You know, that hurts, but it's true.
It's true. It is true.
The advice Man U fans give to people considering the team is don't.
Yeah. Well, there are only three teams out there in the league right now with happy fans. Liverpool, Man City, and Luton.
And I don't think City's fans are going to stay happy for much longer from what I've been hearing coming out of that financial fair play thing.
Well, it looks like Chelsea's going to get fucking bitch slapped as well. From everything I've heard over the last 2 days, they're... they're likely looking at a serious FFP violation as well. So
yeah,
they'll probably get relegated.
Yeah, it's sounding like City's getting relegated if they actually go through with it.
Well, that should be the least of what happens to City.
Considering all those
11 years of violations,
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to get the full extent of their punishment that they deserve because that would put them in like 11th tier soccer.
Beer league, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. It's going to be City playing against a bunch of plumbers who get together on the weekend and play football.
Yeah, but the thing is, City would have to release literally their entire roster.
They couldn't afford them. They couldn't afford to rent on that stadium.
No. No, they couldn't. They'd,
United would move in so that we don't have a crumbling death trap anymore.
Oh my god, I can see United playing at the Etihad now. Right. Oh boy. Yeah. That would be epic.
Just like hastily half painted over in red because it happened so fast.
Yeah, an extra half hour ride on the bus.
There goes Rashford
to get to the new stadium. Yeah. It would be amusing, but I want to talk about Luton because they put serious ass whooping on friggin' Brighton, like just beat on them. All right, they were up 2-0 2.5 minutes into the match,
which is unheard of in like top tier football in any league.
It's insane, right? I mean, I'm used to occasionally a team getting a quick goal. We've all seen it, but 2 goals in 2.5 minutes, the first 2.5 minutes of the match? That's unheard of. I mean, that's impossible, as they say in the States. Yeah, but anyway, I watched the highlights for that, and I was just shocked. Brighton looked completely helpless in the face of Luton.
Yeah. This has to be the least consistent
season.
I can remember.
Mm.
Like, no one is consistently good.
Yeah, go back 4 years, though. Nobody was really... I mean, even Liverpool had a couple of bad moments 4 years ago, and we won the league.
Yeah, it felt like it was more predictable, though. Like, there were bad games. You're always going to have a bad game or two.
Yeah.
But this year, especially it's like the wheels can come off for anyone at any moment.
Well, they came off for Brighton over the weekend. Holy crap.
Right? Yeah.
That was just embarrassing.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask a second question, actually, completely unrelated. Have either of you been following this Elmo thing?
Yeah. I saw Jordan Peterson freaking out at him this morning.
No.
Really?
I did not.
Yeah, he's like, fuck you, Elmo, you hate white people or something.
Oh, for the love of Christ.
He told Elmo to go fuck himself.
Yeah, I don't know how
familiar. And he's shocked he got kicked out of his professional organization.
Yeah, and we wonder. But it started innocently enough. I thought it was, just one of those little things that they do with Sesame Street.
Yeah, it was one of those cute corporate synergy moments.
And it just blew up. Like, it escalated beyond control so fast. Right. Ryan, what happened was basically Elmo posted a tweet. How's everybody doing?
Yeah, and then everyone trauma dumped on him.
Yeah, like something, what was it? Like 1.8 million or something? Or
yeah.
Or 180 million or something? It was just ridiculous.
Yeah, because Elmo posted, then a bunch of other corporations responded.
Yeah.
Then Biden responded. Then a whole bunch of people went and trauma dumped on him. Then conservatives freaked out because he was saying to be nice.
Yeah, I know. I sent Bill one of the responses that a member of wrestling media put out that was like, Elmo, we're all one bad day away from living with Oscar or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the good news is that could give the Democrats the ticket they need to win if they run Taylor Swift with Elmo as VP.
I was just going to say, we're not expecting fat rationality. We're dealing with a country that like 33% of the people now hate Taylor Swift.
Yeah, for no reason at all.
Because she told them to vote. And they know that most people who like Taylor Swift are going to vote Democrat. that's really what it is.
If that's what we need the wind. The...
Yeah, but I mean, who cares? Like, it's she's a musician. She's got opinions, just like every other human being on the planet. We saw this happen with the Dixie Chicks. Remember?
Yeah, it isn't even Dixie Chicks level because she didn't actually speak out against Republicans.
You're right.
She just told people to vote.
Yeah, you're right. It's not even that level, but it's still the same mindless, pointless reaction that it makes no sense because some butterflies got their feelings hurt. Because
yeah.
They're suddenly not the center of attention. Taylor
some
is.
Might call them snowflakes.
Yeah.
Well, they are snowflakes. I yeah. Realistically.
Every accusation is an admission.
Yeah. Yeah. And... Yeah, a lot of times the lashing out is to hide the reality of who they are as a person.
That's exactly it. Every right. accusation is an admission.
Right, and it's just... But I mean, it was such an innocent little thing when it started. It just went completely off the rails.
Well, this was a good podcast for us to get overtly political, because, spoilers, it's getting overtly political when we talk about comics, too.
Oh, good.
Okay, let's do this then.
We'll get some of it out of our system today then, I think.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do these comics. You know you want to. Well, think of the ones of people out there waiting to see what we have to say.
Well, I'm going to take away your ammo right away, Dan.
Oh, crap.
I gave all of them threes today.
Oh, asshole.
I don't remember what I gave all these, so I can't be cute like that.
Well, three of them I literally just read 2 days ago, so that made it pretty easy, because I'm on my first read-through of Sergeant Fury as we do this podcast.
Ah, okay, Nutsack, who's first?
Okay, well, I guess I didn't expect us to go into them this fast today, but first off is Sergeant Fury and the Silent Commandos, issue number 23.
Ooh,
this one is titled
Nobody
the
Cares,
Man,
Yay!
The Man Who Failed.
I hate Sergeant Fury, oh my god.
By the way, this one has a perfect 3.0 average on the site we use, so that's actually pretty rare that it's a perfect, but anyway.
It's a very good comic with very alarming racism that pulls it down.
Yeah. You know, I'm beginning to think I hate Fury more than Spider-Man.
Wow.
No, seriously.
And some light, yikesy topical mentions that we'll get into.
Oh, Dan, you might have some fun with some of this stuff today.
Well, this is why I was saying we need Dan on this one, because I know how you are with history.
Okay, let's, boy.
And this one and the next Sergeant Fury both have some actual historical relevance that I want to talk about.
Okay, let's do this.
Yeah, okay. So Stan Lee writes this bad boy, of course. Art by Dick Geyers. Inks by Frank Giacola. Dick Geyers and Frank Giacola did the cover. Artie Simic did letters. August 1965, release date, 20-page story. And I will take this one away. Strap in, folks.
Strapped in. Cod piece on. Let's do this.
And once again, if the review site doesn't have a synopsis, the comic site does.
Yeah, the comics. I didn't even look this time for the synopsis site because
I haven't looked at the synopsis site since I know I have the next two Furies. I'm just going to use the CMRO, assuming it's there.
Well, looking for their rendezvous point near the Burma Road. Oh man,
that wasn't my historical fact, because the Burma Road is pretty well known. I didn't. Think
yeah,
it
no,
was that interesting just, to discuss.
No, I'm just thinking how this is gonna go. Lifeline of the China-Burma-India Theater of War, Fury and his howlers are ambushed by Japanese forces. After quickly getting rid of the threat, they're greeted by Sister Teresa and a bunch of
there
orphans.
It is. Now, finish the synopsis. I'll talk about this afterwards.
Oh, shit. She informs the commandos she has escaped with the children after the Japanese have destroyed her mission. The soldiers now have... What? That's not proper.
It should say a mission
to take them all to the safety of a sanctuary.
No, I meant instead of four. It should just be the soldiers now have a mission to take them to all to the safety of a sanctuary.
Their discussion is interrupted by three Japanese fighters looking for the fugitives. The Howland commandos take two of them down, but the third manages to escape and report to their command center. Fury and his men immediately leave with the sister and the children to try and make it to a British battalion before the Japanese come back and get them. Percy Pinkerton seems very surprised when he learns that the battalion they are meeting are the Burma Dragons. Elsewhere, a Japanese major is given the mission to bring back the stolen war plans that the woman has in her possession. But remember, that woman is Sister Teresa. Should he fail his mission, Major Itsui will have to commit harakiri, which is,
it's seppuku, but that's the old racist term for them that was used.
Yeah. During their journey, one of the kids blows Gabe's horn, accidentally alerting a nearby
Japanese.
Oh,
that's what they call it these days. Oh, you mean literally. Oh, okay.
Accidentally alerted a nearby Japanese troop. Teresa takes the children to safety while the Howlers try to hold off the enemy.
Now, Dan, just because there was a Catholic nun, not a Catholic school, or not a Catholic priest.
I assumed that my fault. I'm wrong.
Oh God, we're really
you heard what happened on the Titanic, didn't you?
Oh, okay.
You didn't you? Like as the Titanic was sinking, there was a good Samaritan, a lawyer, and a priest standing at the rail watching the ship go down, and the good Samaritan said, "Oh my God, there's still women and children on board." And the lawyer went, "Oh fuck the women and children." And the priest, of course, said, "Do you think we have time?"
Jesus.
I mean, are you surprised we're going here? We're going into race riots on the next one.
We're going all in with this episode. Anyways. Sensing they are running out of ammo, Fury asks for a volunteer to bring the sister and orphans to the coast. Percy Pinkerton offers to do it, for it will allow him to avoid meeting the Burma Dragons. We'll eventually get into why he wants to avoid meeting the Burma Dragons. Unfortunately, Pinkerton and his fugitives are intercepted by Itsui's platoon. When they take the prisoners back to the general reprimands Itsui for not capturing the American commandos. Pinkerton seizes the opportunity to try and create enough distraction for the prisoners to escape, but he is knocked down from behind. The general tries again to force Sister Teresa to hand over the plans, but she claims she never heard of them. Coming to, Pinkerton tries to bluff the Japanese and telling them the Howlers have a plan. But the bluff turns against them as the enemy admits there were no plans to begin with and their goal was merely to get rid of the foreign mission. But before the Japanese execute the prisoners, the rest of the Howland commandos come to the rescue. Afraid he's going to fail, Major Itsui takes the sister hostage and uses her as a shield to escape. Immobilized, he tries to blow himself and everyone else up using a grenade, but Dum Dum stops him and sends him flying. As he comes back charging, Fury knocks him out. Not too far, the other Howlers finish off the Japanese as he manages to send a radio message to the Burma Dragons, and the British commanding officer decides to personally join the detail. When again, Pinkerton looks utterly upset by the news, Fury tries to get him to talk about what's bothering him. After a while, Percy opens up and tells the sergeant that he used to go to a fine British military school, but he led his family in shame because he did not take his studies seriously while his brother graduated with honors. Pinkerton enlisted as a commander to fight the most dangerous battles and make up for his mistakes, and as fate would have it, his brother, who is now Lieutenant Colonel, is in charge of the Burma Dragons. So that's why he's been wanting to avoid the Burma Dragons, because his brother is Lieutenant Commander. Or Colonel, excuse me.
Colonel, not colon.
That's a doctor.
I mean, he's a Pinkerton, so he might very well be a colon. But
yeah. Holy man.
As he finishes his story, unlike Cody Rhodes, Izzy warns the Howlers that they are under attack. Fury and Pinkerton take the lead and manage to neutralize the enemy. When the British arrive, Lieutenant...
I like how to use Lieutenant Colonel as a name in this, like...
Yeah. He asks to speak with his brother. As they meet again after all these years, Percy's brother tells him how much he and his family are proud of his accomplishments as a soldier, and that he'll be remembered for generations to come. And that's that.
Alright, so first off, this is probably the best Sergeant Fury story we're going to get today, if it wasn't for the horrifying racism. The summary doesn't capture it, but this is 1950s Korean War level racism. In fact, it's basically a repurposed 1950s Korean War story, complete with the inclusion of seppuku, because they didn't really care to differentiate different types of Asians back then.
Yeah.
So they were all members of the Chinese Communist Party, and they all committed seppuku when they failed.
Well.
But on to the yikesy thing, and I'm not holding this one against Stan, because this came out later.
Okay.
But Sister Teresa is Mother Teresa.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, no.
I'm shocked.
Shocking, isn't it?
It is.
And she turned out to kind of be a monster.
Well, don't get me started on Christians.
Even by Christian standards, Mother Teresa was a bad one.
Ooh. Ooh, we're talking Borgia. Maybe that's her last name.
Yeah. Like I said, we're getting political with this.
I don't see any reason why we can't get a little political with it if we want. Everybody else on YouTube does. Yeah.
Oh, and we're getting very political. Like I said, the next one, I'm going into race riots.
Woo!
But, yeah, so that was a tough read. I don't think I need to give a full history lesson on Mother Teresa's failings. But yeah, Mother Teresa being positioned as a protagonist saving children is uncomfortable with modern knowledge. On happier historical notes, the Burma Road was real.
Yes.
And I've done some checking with mixed results on whether or not the Burma dragons were real.
There were a number of smaller units. Excuse me, in the Second World War, in that theater, the Burma Asia theater, there were a number of smaller, and I don't want to say commando because it's kind of a dirty word in that era. The commando didn't really take on glamorous aspects of that early in the war. But there were smaller units of Burmese troops who were involved, you know, in the fighting, sometimes on both sides.
Yes, this, however, would have been a British unit that was embedded in Burma to keep the road operating.
I think they may be...
I think there's a fair bit of creative license being taken there, but...
Yeah, I think they're just kind of aping the Chindits.
Probably.
Right, a bit in this, I think, is what's going on.
Yeah. Like I said, I had mixed results on checking. I didn't have any luck finding a unit called the Burma Dragon specifically.
No.
I have found some claims that there were embedded Allied troops in Burma.
Well, the Tamil Tigers wouldn't even have existed at this point, sorry, never mind. But yeah, I think they might be, in a lot of ways, they might be aping the Chindits.
Probably. And just for viewers who aren't up on history, assuming we ever get any, Burma goes on to become Myanmar.
Yes.
Debatably.
Well,
I'm not going to get into that whole discussion.
No.
On official maps, it's Myanmar now.
Yeah. And Myanmar is, or Myanmar, however you want to pronounce it. I'm not sure which is right.
I've always heard Myanmar, but I've also only heard it from Americans, so.
Oh, okay. I've heard the British version, which is Myanmar, so. Myanmar, right now, as we're talking on this podcast, is in the middle of a horrifying civil war that's beginning to escalate. The civil war that's been going on for quite some time.
I was going to say, we talked about that.
It's beginning to escalate now to a point where...
Yeah. I remember that getting mentioned in, like, elementary school.
Yeah, that's why I'm not cracking that egg open, because I don't have enough knowledge to speak on what's going on there. I know it's horrible, but...
Yeah, the little bit I know is it's... there are so many factions that they can't actually... keep it straight half the time. They're not quite sure who's shooting at who at what point.
Yeah.
But the country
I do know it's all the result of an rather unsuccessful military junta that was there for a while.
Yeah. But it's split into factions.
Yeah, and it just fell apart, and everyone is trying to get a piece of the pie now.
Yeah, and the northern part of Myanmar is... Right, the government can't even get there. Right,
yeah,
it's completely under control of these drugs.
It's not a favorable country for any sort of major movement, because the entire thing is located in the mountains.
Yeah, and the reality is, and it's a bit telling, but one BBC show, Top Gear, actually got to go into the northern part of Myanmar. And they met with a lot of these insurgents while they were filming an episode of the show, and it was if you ever get a chance to see the Burma episode, it's quite interesting, right? Some of what they saw and some of what happened while they were there. Nothing bad. They were treated very well.
Groups like Islamic State and the Taliban, people kind of lump all insurgents into a, like, hostile to everyone category.
Yeah.
But an awful lot of them have no issue with foreigners. It's just about the government or other groups in their own country that they're resistant to.
They want a different form of government.
Yes, but if someone like Jeremy Clarkson shows up and wants to film a television show there, they've got no problem with that.
No, they have no problem with that at all. And he got to film. He and James and Richard went. They filmed. They had a great time. It's an excellent episode. And there was very little American baiting in that one, by the way, just so you know, which is unusual for Top Gear. But they, they did give you a layman's version of what's going on there. And it was quite interesting. I'm not going to go into it in a podcast, but, it was extremely interesting, the way things are playing out in that country.
Well, that was a very interesting issue. I would actually kind of disagree with Bo a little bit and say this is probably my least favorite issue of the week for Fury. Although saying that, I did give this a 3, so
A 3?
Yeah.
This time you gave it a 3 this time?
I if it wasn't for the overwhelming level of the racism, because I've been forgiving a certain degree of racism in these comics just because of them being a product of the era they're written in.
Well, product of the era they're written in, and there was a lot of propaganda.
Yeah, but this one went so far, I would have given it a 4, but the racism was so bad.
I don't know. I didn't love the overall story of this one. Probably my favorite part was the stuff with Percy and getting his background out of the way.
The stuff with Percy and the fact that they brought in Sister Teresa and the kids so they could have stakes, despite the fact that the annual just established that none of the Howlers were going to die, and this is way too close for us to have forgotten that.
Yeah.
They did a very good job of bringing in stakes, because there was no guarantee that Sister Teresa was A, legit, because despite the fact that they were using an actual historic person's name, it's not like they haven't used that as a bait and switch in the past.
Yeah.
And, they've proven to be willing to go places with this comic that they're not with the more mainstream superhero stuff. So it's possible they were going to hit you with the mission going wrong and some or all of the kids dying.
Possible. You know, dying in the comic as opposed to when they read it.
Yes. Okay. That is the purview of Giant Man.
Oh, I see.
Oh my God, this comic is bad.
Well, that's why Giant Man got canceled. It kept killing
the Same thing as the Porygon episode of Pokemon.
Oh my God, yes.
Kill a couple kids and you're just gone.
Well,
Pokemon didn't actually kill them. It just gave them seizures, but...
Yeah. Well, as the episodes of this podcast go by, I slowly begin to understand why Spider-Man is actually popular. It's because everything else is so bad. It's not that Spider-Man's good. It's just some of this other stuff is just crap.
On that note, let's get into Daredevil.
Don't worry. We're only 25 years away from... 15 years away from Claremont X-Men.
Oh, goody. So Daredevil.
Yeah, which... Daredevil is surprisingly fun this week.
I'm looking forward to Dan's reaction to these, though, because a lot of the fun stuff is objectively really stupid.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh God,
definitely.
Are we doing the ones I've got here?
Oh yeah,
yes.
Daredevil number 10.
Joy.
Titled "While the City Sleeps."
Wow, what a unique and original title.
Oh yes, that's right. Wally Wood was given full creative control on this one. He even got to write this one. That's right, they made a note of it at the start of this comic.
Stan expecting things to go south and not wanting to get blamed for it.
Which is funny because
he expects that to happen anytime anyone who's not him writes a comic.
He does, which is funny because this is actually the better issue in my opinion.
It is. I was going to say the same thing. Wally turned out to be the better author.
Yeah. Surprisingly, Wally could handle it. Bob Powell did help a little bit on the art, apparently. Artie Simic is on letters. August 1965 release date, 20-page story. And Dan will start this journey for us.
It already hurts. I'm not even through the first sentence and I'm ready to scream. I'm assuming all this Marvel database review stuff, these synopses, are written by... Sesame Street characters or something?
When you're not getting abuse screamed at them by conservatives, yes.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, or Larry David isn't trying to choke him out in the middle of sex.
Okay. Oh yeah, I forgot about the Larry David thing. Larry David freaked out on Elmo too.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I can't stand Larry David to begin with, but boy oh boy. Okay, a mysterious cowled figure has recruited four criminals to, and I'm not kidding, this is spelled D-A-W-N, Dawn Animal Themed Costumes. And it took me about three tries to get through that friggin' sentence before I understood what they actually meant.
Yes, this is a wiki site, so unfortunately you we don't always get the best summaries.
Spelling?
Or yeah, sentence structure.
Or sentence structure. Yeah, so to don as in D-O-N, animal-themed costumes, and act as his criminal agents and begin a crime wave. Sorry.
And boy, do they go in on the animal theme.
I'm hoping they reveal the animal theme in this summary, because that's why I want to see Dan read these.
Meanwhile, Foggy Nelson is in the running to become the next DA of New York City. Much to the excrement of their friends, excitement of their friends, while attending a gala aboard a private yacht being thrown by Abner Jonas, the father of the Jonas Brothers.
Okay, they're just skipping all the important contexts, aren't they?
Well, let's hope so, because, you know, if they don't, this is going to take forever. They are introduced to Bernard Harris, and Foggy is reunited with his junior high sweetheart, Deborah Harris. Spotting the frogman swimming toward the boat, Matt pretends to fall overboard to stop him from blowing up the ship with a grenade before the frogman can escape. Okay.
It should actually just be frogman, not the frogman.
Yeah, I didn't even properly introduce us to all the characters.
Next. Yeah, next.
There's Frogman, Catman, Ape-Man, and Birdman. And they look exactly like you would expect.
Okay, the next thing, Daredevil tries to stop another NBA mascot, Birdman, from robbing a palace. A palace, that's my mistake. From robbing a place and is later tricked into cracking a safe for the organizer's men, which implicates him for the crime. Good. So the furries are on the rampage here, and what's the point of the story?
The organizer's name just got revealed, too.
Okay. Well, they've cut out all the context that actually makes this make sense. I'm going to try to piece it together after you're done, but watching you struggle is too funny to fix it right now.
The organizer's men next attack a party at the Harris penthouse, where Daredevil battles them again. However, the crooks manage to kidnap Deborah Harris, but not without Daredevil knocking out the Catman and turning him over to the police for interrogation. Now, he was a pussy anyway. Tracking down Gorilla Man, Daredevil fights
him. The worst, by the way, of the group.
Yeah. Ape-Man is objectively the worst.
Well, Gorilla Man's just aping a bad guy. That's all that is. Daredevil fights him, but is easily shrugged off. However, Daredevil follows them to their hideout, where he overhears that Deborah is really in league with in league with the organizer. But as he overhears their plans to blackmail Foggy Nelson to do their bidding, Daredevil fails to notice that he's been spotted by Birdman, who's swooping in for the attack. But we're not going to talk about that because this needs to be a cliffhanger for the next episode.
All right, so here's what's actually going on in this.
Okay.
Foggy gets approached by a new political party to be their candidate for DA.
Yeah.
And a bunch of the other guys, everyone else is like a prominent businessman. And then you've got Foggy, who's like a low-level attorney and not even the biggest name in his firm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not me slandering Foggy. That is a distinct plot point of this comic that even if they wanted to get someone from Nelson and Murdoch, it should have been Matt.
Okay.
And then they go on the yacht where they're having like the party, and Daredevil figures out that someone on the yacht was directing the attack.
Sure.
So it's someone in the Reform Party is trying to get the Reform Party to look like victims of all these criminal attacks.
So and that person is the organizer,
which is then just randomly thrown into your synopsis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so then it becomes this big mystery story of who is the organizer and who's trying to get the Reform Party to win the ballot.
So it's it's a bad guy version of the X-Men, complete with yellow spandex.
It's more green spandex, really. We're talking about villains, and one of them looks like a frog.
Look at the next cover.
Frogman is the best.
Oh, I've seen the cover, but I wanted to make a Frogman joke.
Frogman is the best.
But he's not a furry. He's a slimy.
Yeah.
So the Pony Boys, should we go to number 11?
We shall. What were our ratings for this, I suppose?
Like I said, I gave everything a 3. The Animen, yes, that's the actual team name of them.
Yes,
the Watermen
suck, but they suck in such an entertaining way that they're actually great.
I actually highly enjoy them in this two-parter. Well, I mean, most of them, at least. Ape-Man very
generic. Did they come up to the level of Ballsack?
No, nothing comes up to the Ballsack.
Okay, I get a kick out of Frogman, and I gave this a 3 as well. I enjoyed this one.
You know, if he was poisonous and darted around, it would actually work.
Well,
do you even get that, Ryan?
No? Frogs?
A poison dart frog?
Yeah, I got
one
where
of
the
most
you
venomous
going.
Animals in the world. It's a legit. You can be a bad guy and be dressed as a frog. It's totally legit.
They just focus
on
the water.
This guy is more
part
of like a North
Kermit?
American green frog.
Yeah,
Kermit.
Pretty much.
None of the bright, vibrant colors, and he actually looks more like a frog outside of costume.
Wow. Oh, this is going to hurt, isn't it?
Depending on if the same person who wrote that last synopsis wrote this one or not.
Daredevil number 11, titled The Time to Unmask. Stan Lee is back to write this one, so he gets to finish the murder mystery that Wally Wood started. But Bob Powell's on art, Wally Wood on inks. Bob Powell did the cover. Sam Rosen's own letters, October 1965, release date, 20-page story. And unlike the comic writers, Dan will finish this murder mystery.
Oh, yay. Yay me. All right, I don't know what I did to piss you guys off, but... is it my fault your fucking team suck? I don't get it. Okay, anyway, continue from the last issue.
It sure is.
It's time to unmask. It's a time to die. It's a season for living. While an important vote is due across New York, which could place Foggy Nelson as the new DA of the city, Foggy's high school sweetheart, Deborah Harris, has been girl-napped by the animal-themed criminals of the organizer. Daredevil has come to the rescue. Daredevil has come to rescue the girl, but soon realizes that she's actually working with the organizer's men.
Right? She hasn't been girl-napped. She's a girl boss.
So this is what they mean by organized crime?
It's written by Stan Lee. It's more like vaguely aligned crime.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Daredevil is discovered by the Birdman and attacked, forcing him to flee the scene. However, he comes back as the animal men tie up Deborah and Daredevil frees her, playing dumb to the fact that he knows she's working with the organizer in, oh my God, what a sentence, in hopes that she will lead him to the mass criminal. Really, you guys couldn't find a place to put a fucking period in this sentence? Wow. As the captured Catman explains to the police that the organizer hopes to use the Reform Party for his own ends.
Catman really is a pussy. He's the rat of the group.
Yeah. Following Deborah to the organizer's lair, Daredevil knocks out and takes the costume of the Frogman and attempts to attack them head on. However, he is easily defeated and the organizer's men attack a Reform Party rally. That makes no sense. Returning to his own costume, it's like the blind leading the blind. Daredevil attacks.
I'm pretty sure Stan can see. He's just a bad writer.
Oh, sure. Sure. Daredevil attacks and defeats all the Annie men, even though he couldn't defeat them when he wasn't in his own costume for some reason. During the course of the fight, the organizer is revealed to be Abner Jonas. With Jonas and his minions turned over to the police, they confess the whole thing. With Foggy
You're telling me it's the one guy they named in the previous synopsis? That was a suspect. Yeah.
I know, right? I'm as shocked as you are. With Foggy assigned the DA job, Matt decides that he needs to get away from Karen and Foggy to reconcile his feelings and forget how he feels about Karen. And decides that without Foggy, to close up Nelson and Murdoch and travel. God, the grammar. Oh my God, the grammar.
I know, that site's painful. Oh.
No, the synopsis are sort of amateurishly written. But not badly written.
They've been really bad recently as we've gone along with it.
That's because usually we haven't stuck you with the ones that are really badly written.
Yeah.
I've gotten some on that level, but Bill I've actually read the really comic, bad. So I just kind of fix the grammar as I go along.
Yeah.
Because I know what's happening. You got thrown to the deep end where you're just trying to make sense of this.
Yeah, and for the record, and if there is anybody out there watching this, both Ball Bag and Nutsack have actually read these comics.
Yes.
This is part of what they do during the week is sit down and read the comics, you know, cover to cover so that they know what they're talking about when they review them. I read
this weeks ago.
Right. My role in this is to be the ice on the ball sack. and because I don't read these.
More so like I'm, the icy hot.
Yeah, I'm so
no,
I'm kind of
no,
a,
don't do that. Don't do that.
I'm kind of the
don't
rusty,
ask how I know that either.
I'm kind of the rusty razor slash bag of ice that comes in, not having read the comics, and basically tries to give us a slightly different view.
Dan's the straight man, figuratively
about.
And literally.
Yeah, well, that in the fact, I'm actually the token straight guy in this little venture. But it's a matter of, it kind of, I don't deliberately try and balance everything out, but I do try and give an uninformed opinion of it as, you know, I love comics. I've read, you know, thousands and thousands over the years. But it's just a kind of a come in from the sidelines and give an opinion on it.
It also wouldn't be the same if you weren't as curmudgeonly.
Well, that, and I'm not a fangirl over this shit either.
It keeps it from turning into a circle jerk.
If it's only two of you, it's not a circle jerk. I'm sorry, guys. Get your terminology straight. Oh, God. You gotta explain everything to them. Everything. It's embarrassing. Really, it is.
So
today's generation's just.
That Daredevil was a goofy...
Can we
goofy...
get back to the religious jokes?
That Daredevil, we'll get there probably. That Daredevil was a goofy mess, but it was still a fun enough read, made worth it by having to see Matt in the Frogman costume. So
yes,
I gave
it
a 3.
I did as well, but this was definitely the weakest comic we covered today.
Yeah.
I'm willing to argue that.
I wish Stan had had the confidence to let Wally finish it.
Yeah, that would have made it a little better.
A little less generic and predictable.
No, probably still would have been Abner Jenkins, because, like Brian mentioned, he's the only guy mentioned by name.
In the comics, reading them, we had 3 suspects, but the synopsis didn't lay them out for you, so...
Even there, it was pretty obvious it was Abner.
I'm sure Wally was like, hey man, it's supposed to be Abner Jenkins, by the way.
Yeah, Stan was super proud.
Old man Jenkins.
They were super proud of the hint they dropped in the first comic. I didn't pick up on it, and I still knew who the organizer was.
Yeah.
He'd have gotten away with it if it wasn't that blind guy.
And
his stupid sidekick.
His shitty frog.
And a stupid frog. Yeah.
Well, let's get on to the next Sergeant Fury while we still have.
Oh, God.
Energy
really?
For this.
Can't we just pretend we did it and move on?
Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos number 24. There's your answer to that, Dan. It's titled When the Howlers Hit the Home Front. Well, what could that mean? It's Are you saying they're going to America?
America?
Written by Stan Lee, art by Dick Ayers, inks by Frank Giacola. Dick Ayers, Frank Giacola did the cover. Sam Rosen on letters, September 1965 release date. 20-page story, and Bill will cover this for us.
USA! 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 Oh, you actually want to know what happened?
Yeah.
All right. After Fury and the Howlers returned to England, Captain Sawyer sends them on a 2-week furlough to the United States. Sawyer organized the transport, and they were able to take Hans with them. After landing, they all make phone calls.
He went solo, did he?
I didn't hear what you said.
He said Hans went solo?
Yes.
Okay.
After landing, they all make phone calls to announce their visit to their families or sweethearts. Then they travel to New York City to see the sights and meet Izzy's parents in Brooklyn. After a fabulous dinner with the Coens, Gabe Jones announced that he intends to take them uptown to his Uncle Bill's nightclub. However, Reb must skip this activity to catch his train for Kentucky. Later, Bill warmly greets Gabe and his friends in his jazz club in Manhattan. The young GI even plays a few notes on the trumpet for the cheering crowd. When a few bums enter the place and mock Gabe's performance, Fury has to intervene to prevent Dum Dum from starting a fight in Bill's club. So they've already sanitized things a bit in the synopsis, but we'll get to that.
Oh, goody.
because this is one of Stan's most yikesy moments in comic writing.
Oh, this could be good.
You have to know history, but it's top tier. Stan is not as progressive as people think he is.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'll finish the synopsis first, because this is going to be a tangent.
Okay.
The next afternoon, Dino has prepared a big surprise for his friends and takes them all to the famous Stage Door Canteen, an establishment under the banner of the USO. Yeah. In response to Dum Dum's skepticism about Dino's plans, a bunch of celebrities such as Bob Hope and Groucho Marx and Bing Crosby arrive, asking the Hollers for autographs, ready to party. It finally turns out that Dino was not phoning dates from the airport the day before. He was calling his friends from Hollywood. Just a reminder, Dino is Dean Martin.
Yeah, one assumes.
Oh, no, it's made extremely explicit that he's Dean Martin. They just don't call him that.
They call him by his real name.
Yeah.
Dino Martino.
Well, they changed it to Minnelli, but basically.
Okay.
While Dino does a few songs with Bing Crosby, Fury wishes Reb could have been there to enjoy the party, and he decides to phone him to ask him about his journey home. As he and the Howlers are supposed to go and join him there in a few days, he wants to take the opportunity to find out when he's expecting them to arrive. However, when Reb answers the phone, Fury gets a coded message warning him that the young man and his family are in trouble. The sergeant quickly informs the other Howlers, and they all race to catch the next train to Kentucky. As they arrive to the magnificent Ralston estate, they are greeted by a group of Nazi Bundists who have taken over the property. Outnumbered and unarmed, the Howlers are forced to surrender. Taken inside, they meet Reb and his family, who are held as hostages by the Nazis. Reb tells them that they plan to use the estate as a base to steal supplies that are being stored in the area for the Manhattan Project. The Howlers are then brought to the commandant for interrogation, and when Fury refuses to cooperate, the Bundists contact the Fuhrer, who orders them to shoot the commandos. However, before they can fire their weapons, the Howlers fight back. Meanwhile, Hans, who was ignored by the Nazis, rushes to Mr. and Mrs. Ralston and sets them free while the guards are elsewhere. The Howlers soon get the upper hand in the battle, but not too far. The commandant has managed to escape and spots Hans and Reb's parents running away. His plan to take them hostage is short-lived as Reb and Dum Dum step in. Duggan takes a bullet, but Fury enters the scene and fights the Nazi. After a few blows, the commandant finally surrenders. After the military police have taken away the Nazis, Duggan is sent to a hospital. Then a decision is made to leave Hans Rutten in the care of Reb's parents until the war is over. At the same moment, a military courier delivers a message to Fury, ordering the commando to return immediately to England for a secret mission.
How did they get a hold of Hitler?
They phoned him. Through a satellite radio or something.
On his telephone.
They had a huge, like, command center set up in Reb's kitchen because they just turned his house into a full Nazi base, complete with swastika flags hanging outside.
Here mostly because in Kentucky, in our Nazi base.
Yeah. Oh, and all our American Bundists even spoke with German accents, which was something that I had a pretty major issue with. Like, they just, the second half of this was just your random Howlers raid a German base summer story.
Yeah.
This but was quite the raid.
Yeah, the thing I put a pen in is those weren't bombs they got into a fight with at the club. Those were zoot suiters.
Zoot suit riots. I assumed it was part of the riots.
Yeah, it was a direct reference to the zoot suit riots. For people who don't know, the zoot suit riots were a series of race riots in Los Angeles during World War II, where servicemen would attack typically Hispanic youths in zoot suits, beat the shit out of them, and stripped them down for being un-American because they wore zoot suits that wore a lot of fabric. Strangely, they never assaulted white kids for this, despite them also wearing zoot suits.
Yeah, there were a lot of white and black people also wore zoot suits.
Black people were also assaulted, as were Filipinos, but strangely never white people. So it was a series of racially motivated crimes.
Yes.
And the Zoot Suiters in the comic not only spoke with an exaggerated, what I assume is supposed to be slang of the time, but also quite a racialized language. Like, it's not obvious if you don't know the history.
Yeah.
But if you know, they speak like they're Hispanic.
This is actually one of the issues I know most of the historical context for.
I was not expecting you to be aware of the Zoot Suit Riots.
Yeah, nor was I. Okay. Wow.
Because I knew that they existed, but I didn't know what they were, so I actually did some research on it. And
well, there's okay. That, and then there's the, I lost the words.
The Bund? Shit.
The Manhattan Project.
Oh, yeah, the Manhattan Project is... I wasn't even going to touch on that one, because if you don't know what the Manhattan Project is...
And you haven't been watching popular entertainment for the last year.
No, well, but I even before Oppenheimer... It's such a famous thing that
yeah. Well,
I would be amazed if anyone hasn't heard of the Manhattan
Project. I just find
it
hilarious how they worked that into this issue.
It actually made a certain amount of sense.
It did.
It does, because Hitler was aware that the Americans were working on an atomic weapon. He just assumed that they wouldn't be able to pull it off. The Soviets also knew about this. This was not as big a secret as the Americans thought it was.
No.
Right, because the entire organization was riddled
with spies. Something. They may just not have known exactly what it was.
Yeah, but the entire organization was riddled with Soviet spies, and the Germans were already working on their own atomic weapon at that time.
Yeah, the big thing that let the Americans beat them was the Germans didn't trust a lot of the science because they thought it was Jewish science. And that slowed down the German development of the atomic bomb.
But also because of a very famous commando raid.
Yes.
That took place in Norway, I believe, where they took out a heavy water plant and the heavy water supplies that were needed to help.
I think that actually turned up in an episode of Sergeant Fury we've already covered.
Oh, dear God. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But the Germans were looking into atomic power as well. So... And they were, frighteningly enough, looking at the possibility of combining V-2 rockets and nuclear weapons if they could develop one that would work. Right. This was all part of this sort of this German science division's sort of wishful thinking in most cases. But there were a lot of plans for things like this, and when Germany lost the war, America kidnapped a lot of these scientists like von Braun.
Yeah.
Who went to work for the US.
An awful lot of Nazi war criminals became early members of the nuclear division in the American government.
Oh yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of Nazi war criminals who ended up being rescued by the Americans before the Russians could rescue them.
Yes.
Yeah. And
back to our raving about Godzilla a couple of weeks ago, that drove an awful lot of the post-war planning.
It did. Anyway, I don't want to get too deep into it, but the Zoot Suit Riots were a real thing, because one of the bigger problems for a lot of men in the United States during the Second World War was if they were declared 4F, which was ineligible for recruitment.
Yeah, anyone who's watched the first Captain America knows what that is.
Yeah, if you were declared 4F, you weren't allowed to enlist. Now, a lot of these men did go and get jobs in factories and things like that. But there were many of these men committed suicide because it was so humiliating not to be, with your friends and neighbors on the front. But there was also a lot of men who didn't go, who created a subculture, which, Zoot Suit was part of that subculture. That and the swing music and everything. And it was a very real thing. And Zoot Suits were very dramatic outfits, with the huge shoulder pads and everything. And the riots started, and they continued on in one form or another throughout most of the war.
Yeah.
You know, there were constant conflicts between soldiers and the men who hadn't enlisted.
Yeah. Although they weren't always as racialized as the actual Zoot Suit riots were. Quite often it was just, you didn't enlist, you're a coward. But this one was more about fear of Hispanic men taking over the culture.
These comics were written in an era, one of the greater human rights violations that the United States committed when Eisenhower was president, and literally just packed up and banished a staggering number of Hispanics who were working as farm workers, you know, construction workers, things like that in the States. And he basically unceremoniously grabbed these people off the streets, threw them on trains, and took them to the border and shoved them across the Rio Grande.
Old is new again if I look back at what Ramaswamy was promising.
Absolutely. But this actually happened, and this was something Eisenhower did.
Yeah.
He was nowhere near as enlightened as people want to think he was. And, you know, it was a horrifying moment. I can't do it justice. I just recommend anybody watching this go and find out about this.
And just to drive home why I felt the need to mention the Zoot Suit riots, because the summary skimmed over it.
Yeah.
They only don't beat the shit out of the Zoot Suiters in the bar because they don't want to cause trouble for Gabe's father or uncle. Fury takes them outside, beats the shit out of them, and shoves them into trash cans.
Yes. Yes, he does.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all shown off panel, and you just see him walking away with them stuffed in trash cans, and they're presented as extremely pompous and annoying. So if you don't know any better, it's just, look at these losers getting their comeuppance. But once you know the context,
it's even worse.
It's a hate crime.
Yeah. Well, like I say, this was at the height of anti-Hispanic. Feelings.
In the early '60s, and they were getting a lot of the flack from the early civil rights movement too.
They were, and there was just sort of a big white American movement at that time. So, anyway, well,
we still have the Surgeon's Fury of the cover, so let's get. Well, I should say I gave that one a 3, I suppose.
I'm shocked.
Anyways. Sergeant Fury and his Hound Commandos, number 25, Every Man My Enemy. Stan Lee writes, of course, Dick Ayers on art, John Tartaglione on inks. I didn't know there was, I didn't even realize.
Tartaglione is how that's pronounced.
Tartaglione, thank you.
A real American treat.
Jack Kirby, John Tartaglione is on the cover. Sam Brosnan on letters. October 1965 release date, 20-page story, and Bill will take this one away as well.
All right. On the flight back to base. Oh, this one's short.
Thank God.
Yeah. On the flight back to base from the United States, Fury opens their sealed mission orders and learns that there is a spy somewhere on their base and that he and his commandos are the only ones above suspicion. Thus, they are under orders to smoke out the spy. Little do they suspect that the spy in question is the notorious Red Skull.
Oh, no.
Who was using his mastery of disguises to pose as Captain Sawyer. After he briefs the Howlers on their mission, he sends Fury on a phony secret mission to deliver a package to the Free French Resistance. However, these turn out to be Nazi agents posing as Frenchmen. Fury quickly sees through their ruse and fights his way free. I'll mention this here. The way he sees through their ruse is he yells Achtung and they all respond in German because Germans are always idiots in these comics.
Ah, they got us.
That's literally it.
Those
when he is gone,
Americans.
The skull disguises himself as Fury and plants bombs on the base, intending to detonate them, but the Howlers catch on to them. As the skull flees military authorities, he happens to run into Fury and knocks him down. The real Fury is arrested while the Nazi escapes. The Nazi goes back to a captured gun emplacement out at sea, where Sawyer is being kept prisoner. There he prepares to detonate the bomb. Knowing that the arrested man is the real Fury, the Howlers help Nick break free from imprisonment, and they follow the skull back to his base. Although the commanders manage to free Captain Sawyer and stop the bombs from being detonated, the spy escapes before they can learn his true identity. And that's it.
Yay!
This one was nowhere near as good as the last two.
I would say
that's not exactly probably saying much.
From a plot point, point of view, this probably was the weakest one. I will say that I also had fun with this one. Still get a 3.
This one managed to go to three, but it was the weakest of the three Furies.
It's more like this one feels a little bit more like it's filler. And they tell you it's the Red Skull, but you wouldn't really know that like off of looks because he doesn't look like Red Skull.
And that was just the stand thing.
Yeah.
Because he takes off his mask at multiple points and you see his face. And Stan wants it to be something bigger, so he says he's the Red Skull, and he's wearing a disguise under his disguises.
Yeah. So Stan's trying to...
So clearly the artist did not actually intend for it to be the Red Skull. It was just Stan wanted to give him an extra level of menace. So he's like, it's the Red Skull doing all this. But,
Agent Smith, what are you doing?
Yeah. My big issue with this was Stan wanted to show off how clever the Red Skull was. And so he would tell you. And I'm not sure if this was a Stan problem or a Dick problem. But they would tell you.
What, you can't just say Stan was being a dick and leave it at that?
Well, he wasn't being Dick Ayers, no.
Okay.
But they would show like that he was Sawyer. And set up that he became Fury. And then they had an actually funny scene where he got into a fist fight with McGivney.
Oh my god, McGivney.
And he decided he had to lose because McGivney was talking such a big game.
That was the best part of this issue.
That was the best part. That clearly he was a better fighter than Fury. So the Red Skull's like, well, guess I have to lose. And then he loses the fight. And McGivney's like, I actually beat Fury.
And then Fury whoops his ass when it's actually him later again. It's
even though Fury had swam like 12 miles across the English Channel.
Yeah, the Fury McGivney interactions are hidden gem type material in these comics. They're really good.
The point I wanted to make was they showed too much of who the spy actually was, so you didn't have the suspense of is this Sawyer, or is this the spy? Is this Fury, or is this the spy? You just knew who the spy was at all the time, and it took all the suspense out of the story.
They tried to give a little suspense at first, and then they completely threw it out the window.
Yeah, and at that point, it just became a boring slog to the point where it was fully revealed who the spy actually was.
Yeah, exactly. Because at first, this was actually kind of gripping, and then Stan was like, oh, we have to make sure they know.
High hopes that this, because I figured the spy was going to impersonate Fury because the title and the cover of Fury surrounded by guns was going to give it away. But I had high hopes there was going to be mystery of which one's actually Fury. But there was never any mystery. And the entire time you knew which one was the skull and which one was Fury.
And, how could there be a mystery when nobody really gives a fuck?
I mean, actually reading the comic, we're at least mildly invested in who it is.
Yeah, Sergeant Fury is sure pretty good so far.
Sergeant Fury is one of the better titles we cover.
At least one of the more consistent.
And before you say, yes, that is a damning indictment of most of the other stories we're covering at this point.
Yeah, just wait until we get the next...
damning indictment of most of the
just wait until we get the next... Just wait until we get to the next batch of Daredevil.
I'd rather not.
Oh, God.
We're past the good Daredevil story now. Now we have to wait for Frank Miller.
The Daredevil stories are literally Iron Man stories with Daredevil put in.
And Iron Man's generally not good either.
I'm just saying. It's just same story, different superhero.
Yeah.
That's the problem for a lot of them early on.
Yeah.
Let us get to our last comic of the day and start off what becomes the legendary stretch of the Fantastic Four.
This is kind of early days. I gave this one a 4.
Oh my god, but wonders never cease.
That's incredible. I didn't. Anyway, Fantastic Four number 44. This one's titled The Gentleman's Name is Gorgon. So for classic Fantastic Four fans, you probably just got excited because you know where we're heading into now in terms of Fantastic Four comics. This one is Stan Lee, Jack Kirby going to work, of course. Joe Snow was on inks. Jack Kirby did the cover. Sam Rosen on letters. September 1965 release date, 20-page story, and I will take this one away. Newlyweds Reed and Sue Richards work on domesticating the Baxter Building. Fed up with the couple treating he and Finn like children, Johnny Storms out to ride his car.
And actually a petulant child in the process.
Yes. Very common theme for Human Torch. Yeah. A large earthquake-like jolt surprises Johnny, and he soon finds himself being held hostage by Medusa, who claims she is trying to get away from Gorgon. Gorgon uses his feet to charge large shockwaves as he steals the Fantastic Four's Whirlybird. Johnny takes Medusa to the location where the FF previously fought Dragon Man. When Medusa uses her vacuum gun on Johnny to make him flame off, it awakens the Dragon Man. The Dragon Man believes that Medusa is the Invisible Girl, so when Gorgon arrives to take Medusa, the Dragon Man defends her. As Medusa tries to escape the scene, the Dragon Man captures Medusa and flies her back into the city. Dragon Man gets in a clash with both the Fantastic Four and Gorgon. Gorgon claims that he and Medusa are of the same race, and that she is forbidden to mingle with others. During the fight, Sue is taken away by Dragon Man, while Gorgon causes an entire building to collapse under the FF's feet. The end.
Alright, let's start with the biggest positive of this story. Dragon Man.
Oh, I thought you were going to say this is a good comic for people who like big feet.
I'm not Quentin Tarantino.
Or Tony Atlas. Dragon Man is
I figured it'd at least pop Dan with the Quentin Tarantino reference.
No, you're not going to pop me with that one.
Dan is staying away from that one.
I'm not even going near it. I'm just not.
Oh, shit. Dragon Man's definitely the best part of this one. You could argue there's a bit of a problem in this one of trying to introduce too many factors into Finn's at once.
See, that's what I liked about this
there's
one.
There's a lot going on here, but some people might like that.
Yeah, that's what I liked about it, because just Gorgon is not interesting. He's always been one of the least interesting members of the Inhumans. Spoilers, that's the race that hasn't been mentioned yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's what the race that's alluded to in this one.
Yeah, but Gorgon was always like the most boring Inhuman around. He stomps his feet and he makes big shock waves and he's grumpy. It's that's
comically
like
large feet.
Yeah, up to like 1978, 1979, that's still all I know about him in terms of characterization.
Yeah, he doesn't get any real characterization or emotional storytelling points at all for a long time. I don't know if he ever does.
I doubt he ever does, honestly. He's not an interesting character. There's way better Inhumans to use. He's just there to up their raw combat power.
Yeah, he's the muscle of the Inhumans.
Yeah. But,
which is weird, because there's the Inhumans is a race with a lot of really powerful characters already, so
yeah.
He gets overpowered there, or overshadowed there, too. In that
yeah, but early on, a lot of them weren't presented that powerful. Like, Medusa's power is hair.
Here he is, the full-on
Black Bolt's power
muscle.
Is yelling. And he never really cuts loose with it.
Well, Black Bolt's
Crystal's power
powers are very
is,
different at the start than they become. Yeah.
Crystal's power is something elemental.
I want Johnny Storm!
she has terrible taste in men. That's her real superpower. Johnny Storm followed by Quicksilver.
Yeah.
Like, at this point, the interesting in humans are the dog and the fish.
What the dog yes, doing?
Triton.
Yeah.
So if it was just the Fantastic Four protecting Medusa from Gorgon, it would have been a serviceable comic, but it wouldn't have been that good. But throwing in Dragon Man just gave it that little extra spark that actually made it very entertaining.
No, Dragon Man. I always love Dragon Man. He's a perfect boy material. I gave this one only a 3. I didn't really enjoy. This one only was a good 3. Comic, but yeah, because a lot of people probably gave this a 4.
Slightly more went through 3 than 4 because it's on a 3.44 right now.
Yeah. Well, this is only a taste of what's to come. This really isn't.
Oh yeah, this is where
a high point.
Fantastic Four really cooks off.
Which we will see next week, as next week's episode of Route 616 is all Fantastic Four all the time. So Dan
but it's
is
not
gonna
as terrifying be as yeah, the previous all Fantastic Four all the time issues were.
Oh God, I can feel my voice going already. Jesus. Well, and you
it's
wonder
all right
why
if you're busy. I don't need someone
podcast.
Who actually knows history for that one.
Yeah, but you're wondering why nobody watches a podcast. We're going to do all Fantastic Four.
Dan, it's only 6 Fantastic Click. Four. It's only 6 Fantastic Four comics in a row. 7 if you count today's. Like,
yeah, I was dreading again, this heading into it, and this was a high point of the order.
And again, you wonder why nobody watches this.
Yeah. To give you specific numbers, we will be covering issues 45 through 50 of Fantastic Four next week.
And
so we're hitting that big 5-0 for the first time on a comic.
Yeah. To touch on plot points, we're doing Inhumans and Galactus.
Yes, which includes Silver Surfer, of course.
Have you watched Inhumans yet, Ryan?
Oh, yeah.
Comics better than the TV show. The TV show.
These comics, not so much.
I'd say the TV show is much more in line with like when they show up in Marvel 2-in-1 or something, and it's all the B team in humans, like Timberius.
Like Amazing Adventures type dude.
Oh no. I mean, like, the non-royal family ones. Well, all the really shitty ones. Stallior.
I got to bail, guys.
All right. Have a good one, Dan.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You haven't seen the shitty B-team in Humans yet.
No.
There any time they use Maximus as a villain in someone else's book. He has, like, his own band of Inhumans that hang out with him, and it's like a centaur guy and a tree guy.
Oh, nice. We are covering a lot of classic Fantastic Four next week. Just tune in for that and our reactions to that. And it was my first time reading any of it, so it was interesting because, you know, it's built up for so long and kind of live up to expectations. The answer is yes for a lot of it. Some of it, the answer is no, but...
The ending of the Galactus arc, it disappointed me.
It fades off a little bit, but the first two parts of that trilogy are fantastic.
Yeah.
And the end of the Inhumans... I don't fully love some of the Inhuman stuff, like today's issue wasn't anything to call home about, but there's parts of it that are pretty good, and parts of it I don't really enjoy that I'll get into next week. But yeah.
If we loved everything, this wouldn't be interesting.
That's very true. anyways, we should get out of here because we've been here for a while today. We've talked about a lot of subjects, gotten political, talked about Christianity stuff, race war stuff, and all kinds of stuff in between. And we hope if you're watching this, you enjoyed and appreciate everything going on.
And don't worry. We probably won't be getting back to Race Wars until Inhumans versus X-Men.
Fair enough. So yeah, anyways, if you enjoy this one, if you're on YouTube, please leave a like, subscribe, comment, and even share if you'd like to. We are also available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. If you're on Spotify,
drop us a line and say why Ape Man is the best anime-man.
There we go. That's a good one. I was trying to work in something with the totally Red Skull, but anyway.
And I'm not going to do Red Skull the disservice of ever lumping him in with bad villains.
Fair enough. Yeah, tell us why Ape Man is your favorite anime-man. That's a good one. Anyway, guys, we will see you on the next episode, hopefully. Tune back. It's going to be a big one. And peace out.
Have a good one, everyone.